Thanks everyone for coming. This is another installment in Triple Canopy's ongoing residency school here at PS1, Speculations, The Future Is, where we ask a wide variety of speakers from very different fields and disciplines to offer their thoughts and propositions and bets on the future. And one of the very first people that actually we thought of when we started pulling together this series, I'm very proud to say, was Mary Mattingly, because as an artist now for many years, Mary has offered a very rich, dense, both kind of comic and rigorous set of propositions for what the future might consist of in projects such as The Flock House and The Water Pod. So very much looking forward to hear her thoughts of what our future holds in store. So please join me in welcoming Mary Mattingly.
Thanks. Thank you. Can you guys see those slides okay? All right. Okay, so I'm starting with the Whole Earth Catalog as a way to introduce a future, and because I think it's an idea that sort of seems to be overlooked when talking about human progress, the idea of discussing whole systems thinking. So media and the marketplace still promote this techno-utopian idealization of the future, where as much as humans destroy the planet, we will always fix it, what we've done, with another newer and better technology. And of course, we'll be happier, and life will be better, that much easier with the new product. So I wanted to structure this lecture through the lens of the Whole Earth Catalog, which is essentially a catalog for many products to tell a story about the future that's reflective, but reflexive, and possibly didactic, but also whole. So this is from the opening page of the 1969 Whole Earth Catalog. And it's described as an evaluation and an access device. It's been called a precursor to the internet, but of course this would be a very curated internet if that was the case. So this is from a random catalog, but the initial catalog was devised into 7 sections, and I wanted to lay out a story about the future through those 7 sections to posit what it could be like then and what it's like now. So through nomadics, community, communications, industry and craft, but beginning with whole systems. So I'm looking at the potential for a post-humanist future when every living system is accounted for as each one relies on the next. So we saw this clearly in the sped-up ecosystem of the Biosphere 2. When an ant invader proliferated inside of the Biosphere 2, slowly the whole ecosystem changed, killing off first other species, then foliage, which in turn left less food and oxygen for the inhabitants. So what I mean by a post-humanist future is a potential for people to be equipped and able to autonomously supply some of their basic needs. I'm looking for people to be able to participate in interdependent systems of exchange with each other, which to me means looking for the remainder of our needs with human, non-human entities, and also within the ecosystem. So how do we do that? Okay, so I'm going to the year 2000 here because this really influenced my own work. In the year 2000, there were 3 catastrophic floods in the world, and in Bolivia, Bechtel and the World Bank had privatized drinking water. So to me, watching one of our 4 basic necessities become privatized and sort of consumed by the commodities market changed the nature of the work that I was making. I was suddenly concerned for my own self and everyone else I knew. What if our essential basic needs were taken away, and what if we no longer had access to, for instance, clean water? So realizing that dependency and then realizing the fact that I had not a clue as to how to take care of myself outside of the system that I've been brought up in, I went to the desert in Oregon to experiment with these suits that I called wearable homes. So this is an example of one of them. They started as essentially cocoon-like tents that didn't have much function except protected me from the cold at night in the desert. But it became more evolved, and in this instance to the right, you can see a water purification system that was made from things that were found in the desert, and including plastic bottles. So I tried to learn how I could make things from my surroundings to use for my daily life and existence. Nomadics, okay. So the Wearable Homes Project considered nomadic movement to be a necessary part of a future human narrative. As relocation becomes more prevalent, as today more and more people might be forced to move due to the prominence of flooding or storms, anything environmental, political, or even economic. So these are people experimenting with using the wearable homes in the water. So I focused on migration and hindrances to movement, and I would photograph my surroundings in the desert in Oregon and elsewhere to tell this story. And I bring this up in the nomadic section because in nomadology, Deleuze and Guattari describe types of space. They describe the smooth space of the nomad with the striated space of the state apparatus with its laws and physical borders. So as part of the idea of the nomad, Deleuze and Guattari describe the war machine as a collection of nomad warriors engaged in resistance to control. For nomad warriors, war isn't an intention, it's only a consequence. The military, on the other hand, is an organization formed by the state specifically to wage wars and immobilize adversaries. So what's important about the category of nomadics is the opportunity to change the use of the space of the state from what it was intended for into something else. So Occupy Wall Street is an example of the way to use striated space, in this case a privately owned public space, and it was changed from a park for passerbys into a space of protest by nomads engaged in resistance to the power of the apparatus that's in control. So to paraphrase Deleuze and Guattari, the nomad is a way of being in the middle or between points. But what happens when the smooth space of deregulation colludes with the striated space of the state? How is the smooth space of Wall Street different from that of the nomad warrior? I would say access. We're back to the situation in Bolivia. And to posit the very essential question, will we all get to the point when the ability to move is necessary? So now I'm going to move on to community. An important shift in philosophy in the Whole Earth Catalog occurred in the early 70s when Stuart Brand decided that the early stance of emphasizing individualism should be replaced with one favoring community. He'd originally written that a realm of intimate personal power is developing, regarding this as important due to the potentials of personal computing. Later, Brand felt that the overarching project of humankind had more to do with living within natural systems. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the water pod because I was building and documenting wearable homes until around 2006. And their prediction of dystopia and this sort of bubble-like singularity finally felt like giving up to me. I guess mobile housing continued to be my primary focus, but I started to work on a larger space that I could live in with friends and possibly strangers in a communal space in my home in New York. So this is an early sketch of what I thought it would be like. It was a way to explore this interdependence between autonomy and self-sufficiency, but also living within a community. So I had imagined it as the space where you would produce all of your own power, all of your own food and water, and have a shelter. And basically, since you're living on the water, you're sort of not beholden to pay taxes or to pay your rent. Of course, that's not the way it really works, but that's what I had hoped. So designing, building, permitting, living, and hosting people on the water pod all depended heavily on collaboration. So I worked with friends, but also people from the government, engineers, lawyers, business people, gardeners, students, teachers, about 100 people in all collaborated on the project. And this is a slide of several instances of the build-out. It was done in the GMD shipyard and the Brooklyn Navy Yards. Almost everything was locally sourced from the waste stream. So that meant a lot of shipping to the shipyards, but lots of trips with trucks. But we tried to get everything that we could barter or in kind. So the permit process for this project is pretty interesting. It took us 18 permits in all, including a permit to have the chickens photographed. So we had four chickens who lived on the water pod, and they had to be permitted to be photographed. So even with a really big team of talented people, we had some major setbacks on the project, and I could go into that later, but for instance, the first barge that we did all the plans for actually sunk right before we were about to build out, and right before I had signed papers to take it on, which was good. But so it was about 3 years of planning, and the project finally launched in June of 2009. So it navigated through New York City's waterways, stopping at each of the five boroughs for 2 weeks at a time. And just to describe a little bit of what's going on, every time the water pod moved, it needed to be tugged. Unfortunately, we weren't able to move it ourselves. We would have had to have a captain, first of all, and secondly, it wasn't powered. So it's a flat deck barge. That big dome is a public space, so we wanted to have events in that space. That was the plan. There are four gardens that are pretty extensive that provided most of our food, four chickens for eggs. Rainwater collection, there was a 1,500-gallon rainwater collection tank. We collected it off the roofs of the kitchen, which you can see in the far left, in the shower. And then in the center, there are four cabins, so it was also collected off there. There's a greenhouse and a dry composting toilet. So that was essentially the system that me and five of my friends who rotated, so there were probably 10 people altogether who lived on that for about 5 months. This is just some images of school groups, things that went on during the day. And finally, we got to be a park, a temporary park. And I can play a quick video. It's like a 4-minute video about the process. Let's see.
The moment I go to bed throughout my dream cycle to the moment I wake up, it's impossible to not become a part of the organism that is made up by all the people, by the plants, by the water, by the sun. It's like every moment that you're on board, you are a part of this system.
So you can just see here where we would eat, what we did. that was me, but I think I'm talking about how this is a living sculpture here and how every time something changes on the water pod, then it changes the way people interact with it and react to it. So in there you can see here you can see the greenhouse over to the left, the chickens, and the food. This was the initial structure that I tried to design. I got vetoed by the U.S. Coast Guard for that. And I think I'm talking about how if I did it again, I would make it like that. So there was something that I thought aesthetically it was missing at the way it was. And I remember spending a lot of time on the water pod trying to fix it the way it looked, because I thought that it would be more accepted or engaging if it looked a certain way. So we had one laptop for child computers that nobody ever was able to figure out how to really use. We went swimming. Anyway, I'm gonna go back to the presentation so you have an idea about what it was like, or what it looked like. We even went fishing and never caught anything. So when I talk about the project, I talk about how it was really about setting up the parameters to test these living systems. But it was so much more about the chance of being on board and meeting people and encounters that you had no idea were about to happen. When I look back on the project, I think about the fact that it sort of paved the permitting process for more things like this to happen between the land and the water in New York, and that doing stuff like that really excites me. So in 2010, I was invited to go to Bangladesh through Art Matters Foundation and the Bangladesh Enterprise Institute to study architecture for flooding in a place where it floods 6 months of the year. So this is a hut in the Sundarbans in Bangladesh, and I really thought that I would find some amazing new technologies because it floods so often and they're so used to it. But this hut actually just folds up during monsoon season and people move it and then move it back after the 6 months. So a lot of these are housing for, a lot of people who live right near the water in these areas are using these houses to fish from or for some sort of economic, some part-time business. So for instance, these are coconut husks that are used to naturally clean water. This is something that I learned about there. They also turn this material into housing that is able to be taken down during floods. This is amazing to me. So I think housing eventually will all literally need to be moved. And within the context of learning, I wanted to talk about Merrill Ukuli's project called Touch Sanitation. I was thinking about it because she met every sanitation worker in New York City and shook their hand. And what if part of schooling for young kids involved in semester-long internships in every sector of society? So imagine you had to partake in an internship every semester of your schooling from the time you were in first grade. You'd have a much better mutual understanding between people about what we all do in the world. So in my future, this kind of system would exist for schooling. In shelter and land use. So the long-standing story of enlightenment, or humans' advancement over nature, is one that justifies colonization and over-extraction of natural resources. It's one that accepts the current state of commodity economies. A fast migration towards cities is often without ample housing. Larger than all the contracted housing combined in the world today, people are building shelter by repurposing mass-produced materials. So I would call this the future. And this. And I wanted to quickly talk about the Flock House because I think it was important in the way that we use local building code as a guide and falling into, we essentially were able to permit the project under the small structures category. And these sort of groups of temporary houses were called temporary structures and were able to migrate to different places throughout New York City. With Melissa Umberger, we made a comprehensive survey of potential sites that could easily house temporary structures in New York. So these sites denoted open space, public space, abandoned lots, and different zoning codes. The Flock House website will eventually be a tool for discerning building code in different cities. So basically what we use it for right now is documenting the recycled building materials we were able to find that met building standard in New York, and hopefully soon we'll be able to transfer that to other cities. The idea with how we built it was we just used regular straight ladders. We found scrap wood, and by building in the round, we were able to strengthen those small pieces of wood. We glued them together. We then made walls with a geodesic dome structure, which took us probably about 6 hours every time we wanted to set it up. So this is an illustration of the shower system. The shower system is pretty exciting to me because you collect rainwater on the top, and some is held in a cistern right on top of the shower. That heats up naturally in the summertime in New York, and you can just shower right in this tube, and you're standing right inside of a water purification system that turns your shower water into gray water. So then it's stored underneath the Flock House, and we use that to water the plants. So it was a very simple but effective way to water our plants and get clean. So I ask myself, how can safe, portable housing with self-sufficient living systems be built cheaply with a variety of materials? Instead of depending on industry, how can we make homes that are portable or alter them so they have a certain degree of autonomy, whether that means rainwater collection and purification or a greenhouse? And I did this project while I was at iBeam, and I think I was really looking for a house for myself and thought that if I used my fellowship time to design a house, then I could finally have it afterwards. So how can the infrastructure in each settlement be portable as well? What would that look like and how would that function? Would we have interlocking parts that make for scalable units that needed to function one way self-sufficiently and then expand as needed? So right now I'm really interested in thinking about the scalability of buildings and how if you had these small structures, could you attach them to one another and could they become better with more? So people lived on site in some of the Flock houses and not in others. But all in all, we were able to test most of the living systems during the summer. And when I look at architecture's future, I'm most fascinated by projects that experiment with building with what's living on land. So this is, excuse me, on the right, this is a Terraform One project that I think they're actually in testing now. And on the left is a potential skyscraper built from trees. So I'm also interested in building that, building out of what naturally grows in the ocean. And in the 1970s, architect Wolf Hilberts began using mineral accretion as a method of underwater building. So when taken out of the water, these could form such a strong substrate that it would be more durable and pliable and usable than cement. And to land use, in addition to the overuse and overproduction that's unaccounted for exploitation and degradation of the natural world, one of the biggest unknowns within the category of land use comes from companies such as Monsanto and Syngenta and their model of agribusiness, which operates by utilizing a total plant herbicide and genetically modified seeds resistant to that herbicide, as well as non-reproductive seeds. And the scary thing about that is that these non-reproductive seeds, of course, breed with natural seeds over time. So while the cultivation of monocultural crops is dangerous proposition alone, sites like the Svalbard Seed Bank in Norway, the largest repository of the world's seeds, sponsored by Monsanto among others, make a doomsday food scenario hard to ignore. But what could the future of our land look like? So right now I'm intensely following what's happening with urban farming, urban community supported agriculture programs, especially backyard farm shares where backyards in New York City are taken over by farmers and made into CSAs. But also large scale hydroponics in sky farms and abandoned buildings. Aside from standing in solidarity with small farms in our country and worldwide, I'm encouraged by ideas that developed new ways of working in urban space to cultivate interdependent living systems. So industry and craft is the last section that I'm going to go into. In a global supply chain, commodity production can be deadly. We're probably too familiar with the tragedies in the Democratic Republic of Congo over coltan extraction. More than 6 million people died since 1996 because of cooperation between outsourced mafias, brokers, local paramilitary, and multinational corporations. Today, much coltan from the DRC is being exported for processing into electronic-grade tantalum powder and wires. And of course, it's the developed world's desire to consume that's a primary driver of these wars. Many product supply chains go between formal and informal, with some points in factories and other in small artisan sectors, with home workers, micro-producers, or marginalized communities. The informal sector is particularly vulnerable given the unregulated nature of those workplaces. And note what this slide does not include. So what about the end of the supply chain? Perhaps the most wondrous part of this cycle is the landfill. Describing Rauschenberg's combines, Robert Hughes commented, societies reveal themselves in what they throw away. The city describes itself in its own waste. When Rauschenberg was building his combines, he made a rule that everything he used had to be found in a one-block radius from his studio. So, for the commodity object, what is after industrial production? Can there be an after? What about the future, when economies may no longer be centered on mass production of physical objects? Perhaps the production of objects will exist primarily in local spheres, through online maker communities, 3D print and file share programs, with the newest substrate being transformed garbage. As economies become exponentially unpredictable and materials become more and more scarce, might we see booming markets and repair shops in general turn towards material reuse networks? Maybe in this future, multiples will be rare and files for printing specific objects will be everywhere. Speculatively, in a society with less dependence on objects, how might people find value in the everyday? So will social work be accounted for through a rating system like Amazon booksellers or on Airbnb? What will fill the object gap? Will the body replace our needs to express individuality through the things we own? What could the new prosthetic body look like? Or what is the final frontier of the commodity object? So for a century now in the United States, the Industrial Revolution has encouraged thinking and working with little need to understand the whole system. Of course, this allows us to be dependent on buying our food, water, and our commodities we now don't have time to make or the need to understand. In this future, production and distribution needs to be based on either sourcing in close proximity, reprocessing refuse instead of mines, or accounting for the ecological service of a remote land. We will need to occupy places through a different mode of humanity and share the commons with non-humans and humans. Thanks. Any questions?
So we have time for a few questions, and I wanted to start off maybe with a big one.
Okay.
Which is, your future, there seems on one side to be a sort of necessity and imperative to it, and another idealism, right? Necessity because you point out all these causes, these sort of growing concerns that are going to require a sort of more nimble, nomadic existence. And you point out both things that are both quasi-natural phenomena, like climate change, but then also, really like economic imperatives like the increased privatization of resources that we once thought were part of the commons. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, you kind of, right, when you discuss the nomad, especially when you're kind of, bringing in like a lot of Deleuze and Guattari, there's a certain romanticism, right, that always goes with their work. And with the figure of the nomad, there's a kind of idealism there, or at least an appeal in terms of the spaces and potentials that it harbors. So when you're offering this speculation about a kind of nomadic future that has to sort of think in terms of larger systems, is it one you think that is a, and you can say a sort of both, right? Mm-hmm. But is it one that you think is about necessity, about like making the most of what's going to become increasingly dire situation? Or do you want to sort of really present the appeal, the potential, the promise of the figure of the nomad?
I think it's dire. I really do. I think that there is potential in the nomad, and I think that I'm just not sure how long those potentials last. I think right now they're short term, and there must be a way to make them longer. So longer term. So I'm thinking about like the local in a different way. What if the local was a structure of political or idealism or something like that, and a way that people connected from wherever they are? It doesn't necessarily need to be geographic, but there could be some sort of network that could impose itself in a nomadic way on a state. And I think that the bigger that is, the more potential there is for disruption, of course, and for long-term disruption. But I do think that the future right now is pretty dire. What do you guys think?
Other questions?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that would just be through having the tools. So I guess when I'm thinking about like the example of water, if we, I don't know, I mean, if we have to like override some big system in the way that, with what happened in Bolivia, I think that's one way, but I also think that having the understanding and the knowledge as to how to make that work for yourself and for other people is another way. So I do believe in like the idea of knowledge sharing and distribution of knowledge. I also feel a little bit torn about how that's happening too. So I don't know, depending on what form you're using to collect that knowledge, I think can be limiting too. So I feel like, I don't know, does that answer your question, or what do you think?
Well, I think, it would be really helpful if there was maybe a toolkit to begin with. How do people even begin to start the process? That's really difficult, because you're talking about dismantling a larger system that often
right.
people don't necessarily feel like they're a part of to begin with.
Right.
They recognize that they're in the system, and it's taking from them, mm-hmm. but they don't
Right. So there are all these like systems and networks going on simultaneously. There's one overriding large control network, and then there's the informal whatever else is going on. But what if the smaller networks could get together and almost be a match for the overriding network. I guess I see potential in the idea of the multitude and allowing people, like people being able to meet up. And I don't know if it's, I guess my confusion is it face-to-face? Does it have to be face-to-face, or can it be? Right.
How do we ensure that the people who need it the most? And I'm just, I don't know, it's just a lot of, I have a lot of thoughts.
Yeah. I think technology is like is really tricky in the fact that it owns us, the people who have it, and so it's, in a way, it's false to say that it's really as liberating as it is. I think that, for instance, like anything that you can do on the internet, somebody can do to you, right? So you can organize a protest on the internet, and fake protests can be organized by a government on the internet, and you can go to it and be arrested. So I don't know, I think that it's just a careful balance. Yeah, I mean, I guess I think about like decentralizing our resources and the security that allows, say, a building, for instance. Like if every building in New York had a garden on the roof, we would be less dependent on the food supply coming into the city. So is there some sort of balance or some sort of way that we can be more communally self-sufficient on a smaller scale? That seems to make sense to me. Like that would work without going too far where it takes over and then becomes the oppressor or something like that. So I mean, I don't see that happening ever with this scenario that starts on apartment buildings, but yeah. Yeah.
And getting off the grids, there are conversations about that, but again, it's not
right.
Maybe I have been kind of hell the past hour.
Great.
And you might want to do it until 10. My child refused to take the water off of her Starbucks coffee cups and put it by the tree. She insisted on taking it because she paid for it to the garbage can. Also, she insisted on getting a second cup from Starbucks that didn't do her order right. And she insisted on having her consumer rights protected. Everything you say, she cares about. Uh-huh. And all her classmates have the same attitude. They don't want any of the stuff you just talked about. They want their iPad, iPhone, iTouch, iWhatever. Mm-hmm. They're all competing for consumer goods and Starbucks morning and night so they can have a Seattle manufactured happiness. They don't want communal anything. That's what we have
I think they need the internship program.
I mean, that's what happened now.
Well, in this world... So, Peter, in this world, you, as a student starting from first grade, you have to, you're enrolled in an internship program with every kind of sector of your community. So you would have an internship with the sanitation department. You might have one with Starbucks. I don't think so, but you know. I don't think they're allowed, but no. But I think it just could have to do with not understanding like other people's perspectives. Okay. I'll work on that.
So this point you were talking about, at the end, we're in a dire situation, and participation in different exits came up, the notion of the corporate game, which we all know, I mean, some of what's happened, and some of the things I like about what you do, though in a way, just to kind of roll thoughts about this. First of all, ideas of how third world is dealing right now. And you saw that in Bangladesh with some of the images you showed. I mean, so just a question to you is, what's the sort of then, a little bit more, the restrictions that you had to go through for the water pod and you want to go for plugins? Uh-huh. What is the dire get to the point, because I have my thoughts about it as well, to where participation and access is going to have to happen because people are going to have to do it to survive.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because, you know, probably in the 60s and 70s, people just used to hitchhike across the USA and maybe jump into a national park, the tent, and drop out. And now the discussion of what people want to lead, people don't want to have participation in that sense. To do that, to participate in such a thing, you're going to have to drop off this whole network of life, which is controlled by what you get or what you want to have. So one is the dire. Thing for me, when any of this might happen, because you're not just going to go build a freaking water pod tomorrow. You did
right.
Through a whole lot of planning and resources that mm-hmm. took into corporate considerations.
Right.
So a lot of these ideas, like with all art or even an ocean writing or sci-fi or anything, but it's the first thing we're looking at. When is the diet happening? It's the question for you, thinking of the future, where our participation and access would just be, you have a choice. And maybe you should have a giant volume of Mary's catalog of what to do. Which, you know, if the whole grid breaks down electronically, you can get it right at the beginning and pick it up from the library and just say, when is this dire happening?
Yeah, I think right now we're not at the very dire ends, or we would be ignoring the rules and laws, right? But in order to, I think we have this great, great grace period right now where we're able to hopefully do those things in preparation for the dire, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And a lot of this is physical manipulation of your surroundings that you need to have. It's interesting that some of the solutions that you pointed out will be those with technology and those uses. And I think it does get down to a bizarre word.
I've been working on this project where I've been getting rid of all the things that I own and uploading them in, like, as PDFs, 3D models, or MP3s, or, you know, whatever the format is, however I can best upload it. So I feel very conflicted about the need for technologies and in different capacities. Like, I back everything up multiple times, and I don't know. So I'm thinking about a world with less physical objects, but it's also still dependent on some reference to them. That was off topic, but technology. It was like 200,000 came. Yeah. Yeah, I think that having that space, that free open space, wasn't every day, but as much as we could, allowed for different things to happen. Like, people came on repeatedly, kind of made it their second home, and did things like taught their skill of planting, or started businesses with each other even. So it was like a platform for things to happen today, whereas the water pot in the future would be really about survival, probably. And it could, I think the great thing about living on that system was how many other people it supported than just the people who were living there. It would go through ups and downs with like 20 people to, you know, who are all eating the food from it or something like that. But does that answer?
It wasn't a question.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I definitely remember feeling like I wanted to stay on it and didn't really like coming back to, but also that year I was probably a disaster to be around, for example, after decompression or something. But no, that's a really good point. There's like a limited amount of strength that people have to do things. Yeah, I mean, some of the parts I keep reusing for new tests, some of them have been dispersed and given to people who use them for rooftops or their own. I don't know, the big dome from the water pod went to some guy in Staten Island, and I've never heard about it since. It probably was sold for scrap metal. But everything has been sort of recirculated. And the one thing that I'm having a personal problem with right now is like one of the flock houses that I'm paying for storage with. So I will integrate that into a later project. So that's, but I'd love to actually just set it up and live in it. And the long-term part of the project, I guess setting it up and living in it long-term somewhere has been more difficult than it is to set it up somewhere for a couple of months and then move it somewhere else. Yeah.
If you need something, because I guess I have this personal theory that if you need anything and you wait long enough, you'll find it on the sidewalk. So, mm-hmm. I mean, just something like free stuff from Craigslist, but more expansive, like you could get a lot.
I definitely agree. I think that, I mean, there is something called wastematch.org that has been underutilized recently, but I did find a lot of things on wastematch.org and something like that where it's directly going from, say, Broadway plays after they finish a theater run to somebody who needs to build something. We need a better system.
Time for one or two more questions.
Yeah, I think about the commons and the idea, I think it was Adam Smith, the tragedy of the commons, and how the commons probably was better off when it was commons than it is now that it's like government owned or private. I think it's something to question. When I did really think that this is a good point, when, you know, tragedy of the commons states that if everybody has access to this land, then everybody will overuse it and then there'll be nothing left. But that never really happened. It was a speculation that allowed for people to buy land and the government to own it. So I think it's a good point that you bring up. I don't know what you guys think. Yeah, I mean, I guess I've done most of the projects here just because of my own connection to home and my like urge to be part of the city and like learn from it all the time. But that's a really good point because there were times that we definitely needed the larger hospice facilities of New York City on that project, and we had this nurse on board who, like, I had a metal splinter that got infected and the nurse couldn't really fix it, so I had to go to the hospital and get a tetanus shot, for example. But so yeah, I think that that in a way I'm really hoping that we can be interdependent and not like on one side or the other of all these ideas about a future. I think that like we still do need city services and we need to supplement it with what we can do too, because we might not always have those city services, for example. So I think that's where I'm thinking. No, I mean, I guess I would agree with both of those stances. Like, I do think that there are things from the 70s that are recoverable and that are very useful. And we talked about this earlier, but like the use of the dome shape even just signifies a lot of that 70s mentality. Without saying that I'm I hope it's not saying that I want to step back into the 70s, because I'm really interested in the collusion of now and the future and what's happened in the past. And so I guess I don't really know how to best answer that, because I wasn't really present then, but of course I'm aware of what was happening, and from my read, it's really focused on like the power structures of today and how far down the road we are environmentally, even in, you know, the last 50 years. So, both, I guess. Yeah.
Okay, we'll wrap up there. Mary,
thanks
for offering us a future.
Thank you.